Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And hey, Rana and Michelle, you there?
Yes, hey. I'm here.
Hi, guys. Okay, hi. So we call you the money ladies. You know that, right?
So I hear on Twitter.
No, I have to tell you the story. Why? So every time we have you on, we get deluged with tweets and Facebook posts and emails of people saying we love them so much, bring them back. And it's actually kind of unusual because usually when we get a deluge, it's people either complaining about the show or complaining about something else they heard on another show with another host, which we get that too. But they get it right when the two of you have it come on the show and they're like, we want them back. And someone a while ago just specifically sent us a message that said, when are you going to have the money ladies back? So
I love it. I love it.
So you are the money ladies from On Point. Okay. And I seriously, I say this not infrequently, but this one I really mean. I think we should make a t-shirt. Okay. So we're going to make a t-shirt.
Oh my God!
We can do that.
I love it. Pink, and yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I think you should have a contest for best design.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We have our digital person. I'm gonna get her on that. But for those few listeners out there who don't know who I'm talking to, Rana Faruhar is the Financial Times global business columnist and associate editor. She's an economic analyst for CNN as well and author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers, and Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist at The Washington Post. Her column is syndicated across the country. Right now, she's got a 10-part series, or recently had a really fantastic 10-part series called Sincerely Michelle, and she's also author of the 21-Day Financial Fast, so they know everything there is to know about both macro and microeconomics, and we've been checking in with both of them kind of roughly a quarter. So let me first start by asking the money ladies. And Michelle, just start with you. If you had to sort of describe what you thought this past 3 months have been since the last time we had you on with Rana was July, how would you describe the past 3 months?
Oh, I think the one word that comes to mind is terrifying. Lots of people, you know, the extra money for unemployment ended, that extra $600 for people. And there are so thousands and thousands of people still out of work or not earning the same thing. So I think that's the word. And it applies going forward as well, because we don't know what's going to happen. There's been this tug and pull for extra stimulus package. Then there's the election. What's going to happen with the markets? I mean, I just think there's people are terrified, and there's a sense of dread, if I could use a second word.
You're allowed many more than just two. Rana, are you freaked out and dreading as well?
Well, dread is definitely right up there. I mean, I think if I had to describe the last 3 months, I might say head fake. Because, you know, we had an awful spring, and then it warmed up, and we got a few months of being able to be outside, be socially distanced. You saw some service businesses, restaurants, little bit of travel coming back. You also saw people starting to be a little more casual, perhaps with the social distancing. And now there's a chill in the air, and there's a chill in the economy. And we know what's coming, which is round two of the virus. You've already gotten the last couple of weeks, 32% uptick in new infection rates. And I think a deeper recession. And I think that there's a sense of fatigue that I feel. I mean, I feel it personally myself, just hunkering down thinking, how am I going to get through this winter? But I see it around me in the neighborhood. I see it in the national stats. More and more empty signs and windows where small businesses who have run out of fiscal stimulus are going under. You're going to start to see a real raft of that. You know, the deals that may have been cut early on with landlords, rents now coming due, people are getting evicted. So, yeah, it is terrifying. I think Michelle is actually spot on with her first word.
Michelle,
the money ladies, we also try to bring hope. And we have said before that this will pass. But while you're waiting for this to pass, there's just so much that our leaders have not addressed. And I think that's why so many people are disheartened. They're not paying enough attention, or they're letting their differences get in the way of helping so many Americans who are fearful of losing their homes, not being able to put food on the table, struggling, you know, even if you have a job and you can work at home and you've got children at home, struggling to do both. And I think at this point, you know, we're so far into it that any grace that businesses or landlords or banks were given is going to be exhausted. And I think that's what's going to be happening right now. When a crisis hits, when you first fall down and people are like, oh, let me help you up, I'm so sorry. And then as you continue to limp along or can't, you know, do something, people are like, look, didn't I just help you a couple months ago? And I think that's where we are right now. And I'm just so afraid for people because we don't have a good safety net for people.
Indeed. I think, you know, that I'm very worried about food poverty. I'm worried about evictions. You know, but it's true. I mean, Michelle, what you say, hope is also important. And, you know, everybody knows my political persuasion. I'm a card-carrying Democrat. I do believe that if we were to get a Biden administration, and in particular if we got a Democratic sweep, which would make it easier to push through fiscal stimulus, that's what we are going to need to get through winter. I mean, there is just no doubt in my mind. And as you both well know, I'm somebody that worries about debt both at the personal level but also at the macro level. But I don't think we can get through winter without, frankly, without major social unrest unless we get more fiscal stimulus.
So we're going to talk about the stimulus bill in a second. But I did, you know, on the hope front and sort of how hope might have many faces. I was looking at some economic news that we're going to be hearing a little bit later this week. There's some forecasts about third quarter GDP growth. Ron, I was looking over at our friends at CNBC, and they're talking about an announcement on Thursday that could signal something like 30% GDP growth in Q3. So, you know, people are going to be, certain leaders are going to say, look at that, record GDP growth in one quarter.
Well, you know, one of the things that I learned in my very first reporting job in finance at Forbes magazine was everything is comparative. Percentages of what? 30% up from the second quarter number, which was the worst since the Great Depression. Okay.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, we knew we were going to get a little bump. That does not a solution make, people.
Right.
And we feel that. We all feel that.
Because that second quarter was 30% down.
Exactly. So I think we're about net zero.
And it's uneven, too. I mean, when you look at total numbers, you've got to dig in deeper and see that who is doing well. And it's very uneven. And that is what we need to focus on, the folks that are not seeing that growth. They're not got fat 401ks that was down in March and now significantly up, even if it's been, you know, going back and forth down in the last couple weeks. And so we can't rest on the good numbers are great. We want to see it going up, but we also don't want to use that as an excuse to say we shouldn't help. There shouldn't be more help.
Yeah. So can we talk about that a little bit more? Because one thing that you can take away from this sort of weird ping-pongy number with GDP is that recovery is possible, right? So the question is, and Michelle, to the point that you're making, okay, how do we want to structure that recovery? If the GDP is telling us something, and we dive inside that number, where would you want to see the recovery be most vigorous right now, Michelle?
Well, we have to have another stimulus payment, direct cash payments to folks so that they can pay their rent and buy food and pay bills, utilities, and also still helping small businesses, because most people are employed by a small business. We tend to think about our country as like large everything. Everybody works for Coke or Microsoft or something like that, but that's just not true. And so we need to focus on those. We need another stimulus payment. We need more money for unemployment to help tide people over to get us through this next wave of COVID and the winter and the flu season that that will be on top of that. And we don't want to be putting people out when most of the country will be cold. And we know we don't have enough shelters. We know we don't have another place. And the other thing is, which is really important, even if people can find some place to live. Now you're now introducing people to another household, and that will possibly increase the number of COVID cases. So then we've got more people getting sick. And when people are sick, they can't work. And if people can't work, especially at the lower income bracket, they don't earn any money. They don't have sick leave. So it's not like they can take off 6 weeks and still be paid. And so direct payments of people, we know that worked. And I, like Rana, you know, I hate debt. I mean, I've said over and over, if debt was a person, I'd slap it. So you're not talking about two people who are like, yeah, open up the coffers and give everybody some money and, you know, be damned what happens to the deficit. No, we're not saying that. But when people are in a crisis, and I'm a woman of faith, and you know, there's all kinds of scriptures that talk about when people are in need, don't be asking them all kinds of questions. Give them the need at that moment. We will have time to fix this down the road, the deficit and the debt and so forth. And we can recover from that. But right now, there are many people who are listening. If you're not in trouble, you know somebody who is. And that's what we have to focus on. Mm.
I would agree with that. I think that there's two ways of thinking about this. There is the immediate concern, which I 100% agree with Michelle. You need fiscal stimulus to get through winter. You need to help people that are in need. Just to echo the point about most people working for small businesses, and we are about to see a tsunami of small businesses going under, and we've already seen that happening to many of them. Here's a statistic that really sums up the divide between Wall Street and Main Street. The biggest companies in the markets right now, mostly tech companies, control about 40% of the value of the S&P 500. Those companies employ somewhere between 13 to 16% of the population.
Wow.
So that is a big divide. You cannot count on the fact that Google and Facebook and Amazon are doing incredibly well to employ the American public. That math does not work.
It does not work.
So,
Ron, I'm going to take it back from you here for just a second because we got to take a break, much as I don't want to, but we have to. So Rana Faruhar and Michelle Singletary, they are the money ladies here at On Point Standby. We're going to talk a lot more about that COVID stimulus bill, about the structure of the economy, what a productive stimulus might look like, all when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking today with Michelle Singletary of The Washington Post and Rana Faruhar of The Financial Times and CNN. They are the money ladies, as we call them, and we check in with them every couple of months to get their analysis and take on where the economy is right now, globally, nationally, and in your homes, and what to look for next in this truly topsy-turvy 2020. Now, you know, before the break, both of you were talking about how there is a great deal of economic pain out there. And, you know, in preparing for this show, we heard it. We heard it from people. For example, listen to Christine Guidos. She's from Delaware.
There are people that can't go back to work because of healthcare reasons. There are people that can't go back to work due to childcare reasons. So are we just going to expect everyone to starve? Is that the game plan? It needs to happen. Something needs to happen.
So we're going to talk about what that something could and should be in a few minutes, but I wanted to share another listener story with both of you. This is Latrish Osecco. She lives in Newark, Delaware, with her boyfriend and their four-year-old little girl. And before the pandemic, Latrish worked as a contractor doing data entry while her boyfriend worked full-time and had a part-time job as well in order to help make ends meet. And then the pandemic hit, and they lost their jobs.
I was able to receive unemployment benefits, even with the extra $600 stimulus. And I was thankful because I was able to bank some of that money, because little did I know it was going to cost me $604 a week in the motel. My landlord decided that he wasn't going to renew our lease because he sold the house. The only notice he gave us was that he wasn't renewing our lease. So that was 60 days. So 60 days was no time in a pandemic to find a house because people weren't moving. And that's how we end up being homeless. Oh, it was crazy when those benefits went away, because that meant that we probably wouldn't have food or anything like that, because we would have to use all of his income just to keep a roof over our head, meaning the motel. Things were rough because it seemed like everybody wanted to hire for work-at-home positions, remote positions. And because I didn't have the capacity to work at home, the motel's Wi-Fi or even my own personal hotspot was not good enough. So that cut down on a lot of jobs for me. Well, luckily, what happened was I had sat with the New York Times, and they encouraged me to set up a GoFundMe account. So through that, we were able to get over $13,500. And it wasn't just about the money. I'm sorry, I don't want to start crying, but it was just overwhelming. God sent an angel to the motel. I didn't know this person. I asked around because they came and they paid about 3 weeks to the motel for us. And they had meals delivered 4 days a week. A second round of stimulus would mean the world, because we pay for daycare. That was another issue. But I didn't want her to be a part of our adult problems. So I didn't want her sitting around the motel all day looking at me cry. Or if I had an interview, you know, I would have to scramble to see if anybody could watch her. And I'm lucky her daycare is on the lower end, $150 a week. But imagine right now, and I get $317 a week. So if I pay $150 a week, then that's at least half of my unemployment check. I don't know when I'm going to go to work. I just had a very nice Zoom interview yesterday, but I just don't know. You just feel so alone in this world, and it's still not over. Like, with this virus, it's just wreaking havoc in the management of it. And this unemployment nonsense, and it's just a mess. I'm just praying we continue to get through it.
That's Latrish Osecco from Newark, Delaware. Now, Michelle and Rana, and I just... Latrish tells us the story about how quickly the dominoes fall in American life, right? She loses her job, loses her housing, has to move into a motel. And because she's in a motel, doesn't have reliable Wi-Fi to even look for a job. And then the part that just gets me every time is she's like, I still have to pay for daycare because I don't want my little girl to be in the motel room with me witnessing her deal with these adult problems. I mean, it takes so little to permanently destabilize American life right now. Do you see, Michelle, I'll just start with you, do you see plans coming out of Washington or the state level to provide a fundamental, the beginnings of stability?
No, I do not. Give me a moment. It is just cruel that our politicians, and we, let's be honest, and you know, I'm not going to say what political affiliation, because it doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or Democrat. You're human. And we are Americans. And we should care about people like Latrish. Whether you have, and I know there's some people, I know they are, judging her lifestyle, judging whether she should be with her boyfriend or have a kid. They're doing that. But that, none of that matters. She deserves to have a basic life, a job, a way to take care of her child. And right now in Congress, they're, you know, sitting a Supreme Court judge and spending all their time on that rather than sitting at the table and coming up with a stimulus plan for folks like her. That is what is our country should be focused on right now, you know, and I'm just so angry. And I know you hear that because, you know, I work with folks like her in my volunteer work at my church. I know, I hear their voices, I hear their pain, and I can't tell them where to go because there are no resources. And I'm extremely frustrated, and every American listening to this program should be ticked off too, because what's happening to her affects you too. Right. And so we need to make a focus on that. Whoever wins the election, we need to make sure that the first thing that they do is come together to help folks like Latrish.
Rana, do you think that's possible?
I do. And I'm going to offer a little bit of hope here. I hear the emotion in Michelle's voice. I feel it, too. But I actually am hopeful, and I'll tell you why. Historically, you get these extreme economic pendulum shifts about every half century. So this goes on for years and years. You get, you know, market power swinging too far to one direction, and then you get the public sector coming in. This happened going way back to the Gilded Era, you know, and the debt crisis that led to the market crash of 1929. And then we got the Great Depression. But guess what? Then we got the New Deal. And we got a rebalancing, and we had markets that were actually remoored in Main Street. And we had stimulus programs that actually put people to work, but also built productive assets, highways, railroads, dams. That is what we need right now. I will tell you, and this is, again, this is actually not a bipartisan issue. Almost every economist I know would say that if we are going to get another big burst of growth, not asset growth, not stock prices going up, but productivity growth and jobs growth, we are going to need to have a productive government-led, but also private investment into a big deal thing, a big change, something like clean tech, something like quantum computing, something like a major infrastructure plan. Everybody on both sides of the aisle, pretty much in the economics field, agrees to that. And the good news is we do have some of those plans on the table. And, you know, interestingly, let's put aside Trump for a minute. Let's look at, perhaps more centrist people in both parties. I hear a lot of the same things. You know, there is not that much air between, say, what Biden or Elizabeth Warren would like to do in terms of stimulus, or what someone like a Republican like Marco Rubio would like to do. Basically, we need government to come in and seed a new area of the economy. I think clean tech and human resources, you know, the caring economy, which we should get into, would be a great place to put that stimulus. But you need something that creates job growth and real productivity in order to get us out of that. And there are those plans on the table if we can come together.
Okay, so I have to ask you more about this, because so the plans are on the table, but we can't get people to come to the table to sit down to sign those plans. I mean, I hear you about Marco Rubio maybe not being so far apart from Joe Biden. I don't know about Elizabeth Warren. But that same Senator Rubio, I don't see him turning to his Senate Majority Leader and saying, can we do something about the COVID relief bill that the House passed forever ago? So there's still a gap in terms of the sense of urgency between 100%. People in Washington and the Latrishes of America.
Well, 100%. And I would put that down, honestly, to the I'm just going to say it, the toxicity that Donald Trump has brought to the country and certainly to the party. I think the Republicans, frankly, have become a bit of a death cult. You know, I'm looking out, if they lose this election, and I personally think they're going to lose it in a landslide. I'm just going to come out and say that I think we are on track for a Democratic sweep, actually, and we can talk more about that. But I think that they are going to have to do some major soul searching, or just they're not going to be in power for another generation, because look at the demographic shifts that are happening in this country. They are not in their favor.
Yeah. Okay, so Ron, I'm going to just push you on one more thing, because it's easy to say Mitch McConnell isn't bringing a floor debate on the COVID relief bill. But at the same time, couldn't we also say, well, you know what? If the sense of urgency truly is there amongst the Democrats, maybe House Speaker Pelosi ought to compromise a little bit away from the bill that they passed in the House and get something to people now, because they, as we're talking about, they need it now.
Listen, I think that you've got a valid point. And I hope and I pray, really, that if Democrats do come to power, that we don't see a tit for tat situation, because I think that that would be incredibly devastating. But I will tell you, I am hopeful. We talked a little bit about hope, and I think it's important right now. I see a lot of polling data. I'm talking to politicos right now about what's happening on the ground. You see a lot of moderate Republicans that feel that Donald Trump has simply debased what America is about, coming over to the Democratic Party, voting for Biden. And I think that that is going to shift some things, particularly if you get a Democratic sweep.
Michelle, what do you think?
Well, I want to just say, let's not say he's going to win in a landslide, because then people will not vote because they're thinking somebody else is going to vote.
Please vote immediately.
It's dire. It's dire, people. So get to the polls.
Okay, fair enough.
Oftentimes, you know, this is what happened last time, right? Oh, Hillary's going to just smoke him. And I think people just like, oh, well, it didn't go. Like, no, I'm telling everybody, I don't know what's going to happen. Oh, my God, I'm wringing my hands because I want people to feel the pressure.
Okay, good point. I love that. I'm so glad you said that, Michelle.
Yeah. I mean, and I voted yesterday early, and I took my ballot to the elections board because I just don't trust the Postal Service, not the workers, but the leadership. And so, and I, you know, I'm a crier. So I was like, I'm going to get through one of these shows without crying. I have Evan on my books. But I drove up and I had a question because my husband forgot to sign the page. And, you know, he's a guy. What can I say? And so I'm asking them a question. And there were just a deluge of people driving up and walking up and trying to make sure they get their ballot. And we're all African-Americans. And I just had such a sense of pride. And I don't know who people were going to vote for. We can't assume they were all, you know, Democrats or whatever. But just the level of commitment, and it wasn't sort of glee like, yeah, let's get Trump out. It was like, I've got to do this because this matters. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about the elections, I just, you know, want to just caution people, don't think that somebody else has got you covered, that they're going to vote the way right. you would have voted, so you don't need to show up. This is an election for the people, and this is an election that will determine who is going to actually help the least of us, the least of them.
You know, that's a great point. And actually, to your point about everybody getting out to vote, even if you do see Biden ahead in polls, I think that getting a landslide is actually important to getting some of these changes that we've been talking about. Because if there is any sense that, say, you know, there's a divide between the popular vote and the Electoral College, or there's a sense that there's some contested states, it gets legal, it drags out, that is going to unleash a lot of very ugly energy, and we don't want that.
So, you know,
that's
what?
Right.
I'm going to actually step back away from partisan politics for a second, and here's why. Because when we talk to people, everyday people, in preparations for these shows, we don't ask them, are you a Republican or are you
right.
a Democrat? We just want to hear their stories, right? And there is, and I am not going to minimize how much partisanship is part of this picture. But what I'm trying to say is that we hear the same things from people. Doesn't matter where they're from or who they are. The continuity of suffering right now in this country is quite deep. One election cycle is not going to change it. It also didn't take us one election cycle to get here. So what I really want to hear from both of you, again, are like, what are those deeper changes that we need to make, right? Because,
you're
we were talking about that this cascade of problems that's going to hit people again this winter. Evictions, job loss, food insecurity, all of these things. So I guess what I'm saying
is... No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
What are the actual concrete steps we need to take, no matter who's in the White House or who's in Congress? Like, I want to get a better understanding from you guys of what that is. And Michelle, we've got about a minute before we have to take another break.
Sure.
So
a couple quick things. Addressing the minimum wage issue, fixing Social Security to make sure we shore up the one, a program that keeps millions of people out of poverty. You know, looking at unemployment, whether there needs to be some adjustment about that. Fixing the systems that disperse unemployment. We realize what that happened. And I think, again, a stimulus package, those are sort of the concrete things that we can do right now. The stimulus, you know, short term, but those other things long term, particularly minimum wage, making sure people have a living wage.
And Ron, I'm going to get your answer when we come back from the break, because I don't want to have to cut you off again. But we are talking with Rana Fruhar and Michelle Singletary. They are our money ladies. And, you know, guys, I'm watching our James Ross. He's our technical director. And when the two of you are on, I get amped up too a lot. I see him bringing down the fader because I, like, start yelling. passionate conversation with the two of you. So we'll have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we are so glad to have our money ladies back with us today. Michelle Singletary, she's the nationally syndicated personal finance columnist from the Washington Post, author of the 21-Day Financial Fast, and Rana Fruhar is back with us as well. She's the Financial Times Global Business columnist and associate editor there, CNN Global Economic Analyst, and author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. And Rana, in a couple of minutes, I'm going to come back to you because I really want to spend the last portion of the show talking about, like, how do we achieve the structural change we need. But before that, I was wondering if the two of you could just kind of sit back and listen again with me to some of our listeners, because really there's so much to learn about what they are actually experiencing every day. So a couple of minutes ago, we heard from Latrish Osecco from Newark, Delaware, and there's something that she said in her diary with us that I just wanted to play again.
I know it's other people. I know I can't be the only one, you know, and it's just heart-wrenching and heartbreaking. And, oh, my God, you just feel so alone. And, you know, everybody's going through it, but you just feel so alone in this world. And it's just a mess.
So Latrish talked about loneliness, even in a moment where tens or hundreds of millions of Americans are really feeling a lot of economic pain. And what was so interesting is a couple of other people we talked to just unbidden brought up this feeling of loneliness. For example, here's another person we spoke with.
And the worst part is knowing that I wasn't the only one. I know there are other people in the same situation, and I know what they're going through, and I know that they feel so alone, and like they're the only ones thinking, and they're not. I know that now, and I hate that.
So that just happened. We didn't ask them about how they felt about that loneliness of economic pain. They brought it up themselves. And so who you just heard from, her name's Erin Bailey. She lives in Florida. She's a single mom of four. And she told us more about why she knows what it's like to really feel alone right now.
before everything started, we were doing well. I had actually started my own lawn care business and also did things like car detailing, car washing, house cleaning, you know, basically any kind of odd job. I had went out and just wanted to do, you know, my own business and got the business cards and started doing the advertising online. And then once the quarantine started, people didn't want anyone around. You know, they didn't want anyone near their property. And then also it would be hard because the schools had closed, which was my child care. So finding someone to watch the kids was really impossible. I mean, regular child cares were closed as well, but I couldn't have afforded one of those. When I was trying to look for assistance, I would call different places, you know, looking for rental assistance, call the Lord's Place and Adopt a Family and this place and that place. And you would get put in a circle, basically. This place would say, oh, well, we don't help with that, but you need to call this place. Or this place would be like, oh, well, we can't help you until you're actually homeless, so you need to call this place. And then they would say, oh, no, you don't need to call here, you need to call there. So it was basically just this big web of getting nowhere. No one could have bailed us out. We wouldn't have been able to be bailed out at all. We had gotten to the point after waiting so long and trying for so many resources that there was no way that we were going to get dug out of the hole we were in. There's no way. Because that process went on for so long and we got so much more behind as time went on everything. It is the most heartbreaking feeling to know that you are trying every single thing you can think of and reaching out to every place you can think to reach out to, and you're not getting anywhere. It's soul-crushing.
Erin says her family was headed to, in her words, a dark place. So in September, she turned to a GoFundMe campaign that's received more than $68,000 in donations.
Today, I don't have to worry that my kids are not going to have a place to lay down tomorrow. You know what I mean? I don't have to worry, you know, if we're going to have to try to sleep in our car until possibly our car gets repoed. You know, I don't have to worry about those things. Like, there are other parents out there right now who have that worry every day because they've tried to do the same things I've tried to do to get the help, and they didn't get the help like I did.
That's Erin Bailey. She spoke to us from West Palm Beach, Florida. So, Rana, I'm going to come back to you on the solutions front here because, you know, both Erin and Latrish, who we heard from earlier, basically what they got was a GoFundMe stimulus. Okay, so that's the plan now that many people are relying on is GoFundMe. What you just wrote about this. So what does true economic justice look like now or should look like going forward?
Well, for starters, let me just say I'm so glad that you gave us these two snapshots of real individuals because, you know, I deal in hard economic data and that can get very distancing. But when you hear from people in their felt experience, that's when it begins to go to your heart. And what's interesting at the moment is the needs of the two individuals and frankly the millions of individuals that are very much like them right now in this country and what economists would say and I would say that we need right now policy wise are actually interlinked. And let me explain what that means. I think it's wonderful that people on GoFundMe are individually giving help to people in need. I've done that for some small businesses in my area. That does not make for a stable country and a stable liberal democracy. You need a public social safety net. You cannot rely on the largesse of people online to put a safety net under all of us. It's interesting too, because the fact that this is happening through GoFundMe, it's, you know, a tech startup, great startup, underscores another important point right now. There are actually, interestingly, a lot of new businesses being created. The number of new business creation filings are up nearly 20% this year over last year. That is in part because people have to do something. They have to become entrepreneurs because they've been put out of traditional jobs. Now, that sounds like a good thing, right? But many of these businesses are digital. They are using software, automation to replace workers. So this shift to a digital economy, which we knew was going to challenge jobs, it's already challenged blue-collar jobs for the last 30 or 40 years. It's now challenging white-collar jobs higher and higher up the food chain. That's been put on steroid by COVID, by the COVID pandemic. So fast forward, when we come out of this pandemic in a year or two, we are still going to be in a jobless recovery. So what can we do about this? We need two things. We need some long-term productive stimulus that is linked to high growth areas. And we need, you know, clean tech, digital computing, new cutting edge computing technologies. I could go on and on. We kind of know what the five or six baskets are. But crucially, we need this to be linked to the development of people, of human capital, educational reform that helps train people for these jobs, healthcare that puts a safety net under Americans, by the way, one third of whom cycle in and out of poverty because of a healthcare emergency, which is it's not only inhumane, but it's just absurd from a political and a economic productivity standpoint. Finally, the caring economy. What are the jobs that the robots are not going to be able to do? Childcare, healthcare, looking after people. These are the things that we should be investing in right now. You know, Warren Buffett once told me years ago, this was a decade ago nearly, that the most growth enhancing thing that he thought policymakers could do would be to help put more women into the workforce at both the upper levels and the lower levels by creating federally funded childcare. And I listened to your program that you did a while back talking about this. If we could give proper wages and benefits to childcare workers, it would not only help them, help bolster the consumption economy, help create a generation of healthier children, and help put women with higher levels of education to work in high income, high productivity jobs. No brainer, people. These are the things that are on the table. We can make them happen.
Okay, Michelle, what do you think?
I think she's all right. I mean, when we're talking about, and this is where we have stalled in our country. All the things that Rhonda just talked about are things that people don't want to pay for. But in the long term, it will help our economy. And I agree. I'm just thrilled that those women were able to get help through GoFundMe. And I know that every time I write about an individual and something happens, readers contact me and want to give and help them. And that's great, but that's just one, you know, subject of one column. And so when we talk about, like, for example, even just the federal childcare, which she just talked about, you know, if you have a way to help people go out to work, because you heard one of your guests say, one of the women, I think it was Latrice, was said that the money that she got in unemployment, half had to go to childcare. So if we have subsidized childcare, and then we have a working wage for the people who work there, because I'll tell you, there's such an turnover on those jobs because the pay is so low that they can't keep qualified people. So that and this all works in connection. But as the American public, and I'm appealing to everybody who's listening, we have to be able to shake this idea that you're helping people who don't deserve to be helped, that you got to be able to say, I'm okay funding these type of programs, because anytime these kinds of things come up, that's what happens. People don't want to fund them. They don't want to subsidize things. They don't want to have subsidized medical care or child care. But look at what we have right now. This is why we have so many people falling through the cracks, because if they have those subsidies, if they have a working wage, they can save more. And so when we have these crises, hopefully prayfully, we will never have another pandemic. But, you know, we're going to have another economic crisis because they come. But when they come, if we do all these things that Rhonda just talked about, that will free up people's money in their budget to save so they can help themselves during those times where we do have an economic downturn. So whoever we get in the next election, as American folks, we have to be willing, those of us who can afford it, and there are, to give up some of that, maybe pay a little bit in more taxes so that we create this safety net that Rhonda was just talking about. I'm okay with having one less television. I'm okay with not keeping my car for 10 years if it means that folks like we just listened to, Latrish and Aaron, will have a safety net for when the economy takes a downturn.
But Michelle, you're not the one who has to have one less television, right? It's not most of us who would have to do with less. I mean, what we haven't talked about is the inequality that's the specter behind so much of this. We're not asking for the average American to say, well, I'm going to keep my car for an extra 5 years so that I can help subsidize childcare for my neighbor. I don't think that's what anyone here is saying, right?
But, you know, go ahead, Michelle.
No, what I was saying is that there is in this country, anytime politicians say, let's create a safety net, there is a huge backlash. And because they don't have a backbone, they don't vote in things that will create a safety net. Mm-hmm. I mean, even look at Social Security. There's all this debate still about Social Security, which we know keeps people out of poverty.
You know,
that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that as a collective, we have to be able to say, okay, some of us are going to have to give up some more when we talk about tax increases so that we can create these safety nets. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
One final point. I hear, Michelle, I actually think your point about one less TV is important. In the last 40 years, we said, let's all have low, low prices. Let's send jobs abroad. Let's let software do it because we're going to become a consumption economy and the prices of those TVs will fall. And they guess what they did? We had a Walmartization and now an Amazonization of the economy. Guess what? Low prices equal low wages. Mm. That's what we need to fix.
Mm. Well, and the fixes need to come at... I wanted to end with a hope, but I keep getting dragging back.
Well, Magna, there is hope because the pendulum is shifting. We are moving. I think that we are moving, full disclosure, topic of my next book, to a more localized paradigm. I think that we're going to see a little bit less focus on global, a little bit more focus on local, on community. I'm not talking about some Hobbesian return to nationalism of the 1930s, but I already see all kinds of technological shifts and demographic shifts pushing things to the local level where you can create real economic hubs. And maybe, you know, frankly, maybe that's the topic of another conversation for us at another time. By the way, I also have a slogan for the Money Ladies.
Okay.
You'll laugh, you'll cry. Right? Good. Put that on your t-shirt.
I'll take ownership of the crying. But on that point, I think that's just such an excellent point. I think whenever something terrible happens in my life, I always look at what can I learn from it? What can I do to make myself better? And I think this pandemic has showed us all the holes that we have in our economy. And if we are smart, if our politicians are smart and humane, we will learn from that and we will put things in place, like the fact that we need manufacturing in our country so that we know that some of those jobs are secure jobs for folks. And I'm hoping that those are the things that we take out of the pandemic and that we do change and understand that when you lift someone else up, you lift yourself up.
That's right. And then when we don't participate communally in a society that looks after each other, we end up paying for it somehow anyway.
We do. We absolutely do. Indeed.
All right. Well, you know what? With that, the Money Ladies are signing off for another hour. We're going to have you back hopefully sooner rather than later. So Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist, nationally syndicated with The Washington Post, author of The 21-Day Financial Fast, and also her 10-part series called Sincerely Michelle. Michelle, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Oh, I just so enjoy the conversation and love just talking to both of you and your listeners.
and Rana Faruhar, Financial Times Global Business columnist and associate editor there, and global economic analyst for CNN, author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. Rana, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me, as always.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll bring those money ladies back soon. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.